Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Moss, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday, the 29th of January, these are our main stories. Iran has denied being responsible for a drone attack which killed three US servicemen. President Biden is promising a tough response. The UN agency UNRWA says its operations in Gaza will have to stop if funding isn't restored. And China's property giant Evergrande faces being liquidated after its debts reached $300 billion. Also in this podcast, Japan's lunar lander SLIM appears to have woken up after receiving a burst of energy from the sun. And also in this programme,
people who engaged with music throughout their life performed better on our tests and had better memory and problem-solving skills than those who didn't.
Why playing an instrument can stand you in good stead for old age. Iran has given its first comment on the death of three US servicemen in a drone attack, and it can basically be summed up as, it wasn't us. It certainly was a Shia militia group which claimed responsibility for striking the American military base in Jordan. And groups like this are funded and supplied by Iran. But speaking on state television, the country's intelligence minister, Esmail Khatib, seemed to distance Iran from the operation, insisting those who did it operated at their own discretion. Perhaps Iran is getting nervous about how the US will respond to the attacks. Have no doubt, said President Biden, we will hold all those responsible to account at a time and in a manner of our choosing. Meanwhile, Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak spoke in a rather more diplomatic, less threatening tone when asked for his reaction to the drone strike.
We are concerned and would urge Iran to continue to de-escalate tensions in the region. We absolutely condemn what has happened over the past couple of days. My thoughts are with all of those impacted, those who have lost their lives, their families, and those that are injured. We stand resolutely with our allies to bring stability and peace to the region, and that's what we'll continue to work towards.
Well, I spoke about this with the BBC's international editor, Jeremy Bowen, who first gave me more details about the attack itself.
What we know is that the Americans have got various bases, which are, in this case, either side of the border between Jordan and Syria. And the one in Syria has been attacked before, but there's a sort of logistics hub, which is just in Jordan. And it seems that this is, I think it's called Tower 22. And this is what was attacked. And in a sense, it was only a matter of time before this happened, because there'd be many attacks on American forces in Syria and Iraq, who've been there for many years, but there have been many fresh attacks on them since the war started in Gaza on October the 7th. And sooner or later, they were bound to kill some Americans, and they have succeeded in doing that.
It's often claimed that the Shia groups that are being held responsible are armed and supplied by Iran, but Iran says it wasn't involved in this. Does that denial carry much credibility?
Not a great deal, because these militias, while, yeah, they have, I imagine, a certain amount of freedom of action, the fact is that they get their training, they get their weapons, they get their money from the Iranians. The Iranians have built up a network of these militias over many years, which they regard as their forward defensive apparatus. And, of course, Iran's enemies regard it as their network of terror.
What everyone fears, then, is a direct conflict between the US and Iran. And I'm wondering if what's just happened with President Biden promising some kind of retaliation, I mean, has that become more likely?
I think it's a step closer to it happening. Depends now, really, the ball's in the American court. What are they going to do? Don't forget, it's election year over there. The Republicans are giving Biden a hard time about what they say is his failure to deal with this sooner. There are people there in America saying, hit Iran very hard, not Trump, interestingly, but others on the right. And, you know, the Americans, I'm pretty sure, have not directly tried any military activity on Iranian soil since a botched attempt to rescue U.S. hostages back in 1980. more than 40 years ago. And if they hit something on Iranian soil, that would be a massive escalation. So I somehow doubt that's going to happen. But they're going to search for some sort of middle ground. Maybe Iranians in Syria, maybe Iranian naval assets in the Gulf. They have a range of options, which no doubt they've worked up over quite some time. And the Pentagon will be giving the president a range of things which he might do. And at some stage, probably fairly soon, because he's under pressure to act, they will do something.
Jeremy Bowen. The latest round of missile, drone and rocket attacks began, of course, after fighting broke out between Israel and Gaza, which in turn followed the Hamas attacks of October 7th. But the humanitarian situation in Gaza itself now looks more perilous than ever. Much of the aid that keeps people alive there is supplied by UNRWA, the United Nations agency. But now France and Japan have joined other countries in cutting their funding for UNRWA. This follows a claim by Israel that UNRWA staff were involved in those October 7th attacks. As a result of these cuts, UNRWA says it may have to stop delivering aid to Gaza altogether. The head of the Norwegian Refugee Council, Jan Egeland, told the BBC that suspending funding to the UN agency was reckless.
They would run out of money. Very soon, they are already underfunded, under incredible strain, as 3,000 of their 13,000 staff in Gaza are heroically meeting to work every morning and take care of a million people that are sheltering in UNRWA facilities. I mean, this is an incredibly disappointing and reckless act by these nine donors who profess to be working according to good humanitarian donorship, which on which one of the basic principles is to not punish starving children for whatever would have been done by some of the staff of the organization. So this has to be reversed immediately. If not, there will be a collapse in all relief in the Gaza Strip.
The humanitarian situation in Gaza has already regularly been described as catastrophic, with words like famine being used and fears of disease spreading. So I asked our correspondent in Jerusalem, Mark Lowen, if UNRWA quit, could it get any worse?
Well, it could get significantly worse because UNRWA's role at the moment is the sole distributor of aid that Israel is allowing into Gaza, Paul. So, and it provides the shelters and the refugee camps that other international bodies can't do because they just can't operate there, very many of them anymore. But to be frank, I don't think that UNRWA is going to stop operating because it is in the interest of no Western government that happens. And indeed, probably not in the interest of the Israeli government either. Because Israel would then be in charge of or tasked with distributing aid, which it doesn't want to do and doesn't really have the capacity to do while it's launching an offensive in Gaza. So I think probably this is a temporary suspension. The EU, for example, has said that it's ordered an urgent audit of UNRWA and has stopped funding until the end of February at the moment. But I think that even though this is a serious situation for the agency, and the head of UNRWA says, you know, the life-saving assistance on which 2 million people depend is about to end, I think that this is, to some extent, the Western government saying, we take these allegations seriously, we are supportive of our ally Israel, while at the same time maintaining a lot of pressure on the Israeli government to ease its offensive.
Briefly, Mark, I just wondered if you could give us an update on the fighting in Gaza, because we're told that Israel says it killed dozens of militants overnight.
Yeah, the Gaza health officials, health ministry run by Hamas, says that 140 people were killed in the last 24 hours. Israeli aircraft hit two compounds, say the Israeli Defense Forces, killing, in their words, terrorists. I mean, clearly the Israeli military is not letting up on its offensive. And a lot of the fighting, and some of the worst fighting, is around the hospitals there, which are increasingly starved of medicines and supplies and are in a desperate situation.
Mark Lowen. Member states of the European Union often have their differences with the people in Brussels who run it. But the Financial Times newspaper has claimed that a bust-up is now brewing with one country, which threatens a whole new order of diplomatic meltdown. Hungary has been using its veto to stop some aid being sent from the EU to Ukraine. Hungary's Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, being very friendly indeed with Vladimir Putin. And according to the Financial Times, if this continues, the EU plans to take action to sabotage Hungary's economy, imperil its currency, and try to scare away foreign investors. Now, just to put this in context, the EU has previously punished errant countries by withholding funding, but no EU official has ever talked about attempting the wholesale destruction of a member's economy. So what's going on? Our correspondent in Hungary, Nick Thorpe, says people on all sides are finding the newspaper's claims quite a surprise.
It is an extraordinary document or allegation of a document. So according to that, quoted by the Financial Times, they've identified an EU official, the EU, this is a policy paper, they've identified the weakest points of the Hungarian economy, high inflation, high foreign debt, weak currency, and they would effectively aim to hit each by withholding all EU money, which Hungary can get as a member state. So this is definitely the nuclear option. The FT hasn't published the document, nor have we, the BBC, seen it, but the paper says several EU diplomats confirmed its validity. So words like sabotage, blackmail being bandied around this morning don't seem like any exaggeration.
What would you think would happen if the EU did really try to hobble the whole Hungarian economy? I mean, can you imagine the Prime Minister Viktor Orban going, OK, fair enough, you win, I'll back down and I'll drop my veto?
Well, this is all, of course, sort of a negotiation, although a very tough negotiation, ahead of Thursday's emergency EU summit on aid for Ukraine, on this financial package prevented by Mr. Orban in December. The government, the Hungarian government, seems to have got wind of this threat, this nuclear option, effectively, from the EU, and it put in its own counter-proposal already. So there are already signs of a Hungarian backdown, but not on everything. Put very succinctly, Hungary might drop, according to what I'm hearing here in Budapest, its objections to money for Ukraine being raised from the existing EU budget. Also, it would drop its objections to the EU taking out a credit on the markets to pay to Ukraine. But Hungary would stick to, Mr. Orban's government would stick to certain caveats. It would demand that this remains an issue of unanimity, and that, in other words, Hungary would maintain a veto, even though it would back down on the content of any aid offered to Ukraine.
Nick Thorpe. 14-year-old Abada was one of the first people to die this year trying to cross from France to England on a small boat. He and his older brother Isa had left Syria in May last year in an effort to reunite with family already in the UK. But they were among five people who drowned after falling from an inflatable dinghy 2 weeks ago. Our Paris correspondent Andrew Harding has been investigating the decisions that led to this fatal journey.
I've come to the spot where a 14-year-old Syrian boy, Obada, drowned. Two survivors from that cold night are with me, friends from the same Syrian town. They're pointing to where Obada, the 14-year-old, disappeared and drowned just so close to shore. He couldn't swim, and the smuggler hadn't given them any life jackets. But why was a child caught up in such a dangerous journey? In West London, we've arranged to meet another of Obada's brothers, 25-year-old Nader. He's now a refugee here, having successfully crossed from France in a small boat 2 years ago. He had encouraged Obada to leave Syria and to make the same journey.
He told me when he came here, he wanted watch football game in Arsenal.
Now he's consumed with regret.
And now, do you think maybe he should have stayed in Syria?
Yes.
Assalamu alaikum.
His parents sent us this video footage showing Obada's bedroom. They'd also pushed him to make the trip to England, wrongly believing they might then follow him legally, given his young age. In Calais, two Syrians who'd accompanied Obada on the whole journey told me more.
Faris said Obada was always scared.
He was just a child. We tried to reassure him. We held his hand on the boat. We told him he needed to be stronger. But he couldn't swim, and he just got scared.
Faris explained how the group finally reached Italian waters, where they were rescued by coast guards, registered, and then allowed to carry on to France.
When he entered the Italia, I told him go to Germany.
In London, Obada's brother warned them that England was tightening its rules, that it might be better to head to Germany. But Obada said he knew no one there.
We want all my family same country.
And so to Calais. This video was shot just hours before Obada drowned. He's sitting around a fire with his brother and the other Syrians. A smiling Obada holds up two fingers in a victory salute. It's left to his brother, Nader, in London, to acknowledge the family's own role in what's happened.
Do you feel guilty?
Yes. Yes.
How should we judge Obada's story? Many people will be inclined to condemn his parents and family for risking the life of a child on such a journey. Others, not least those with direct experience of life in war zones like Syria, will say that it's a measure of the family's desperation that they took such a step.
Andrew Harding. You know that feeling when you think one of your electronic devices is on its last legs. Maybe your laptop is flashing battery warning signs, or your mobile really is almost completely out of juice. And then, miraculously, you discover it's got a bit more power than you thought. Well, that's just happened in a rather more spectacular way on the moon. Japan's lunar lander, known as SLIM, touched down more than a week ago, in the right spot at the right time, but at the wrong angle, and that meant its solar panels failed to work properly. But now it's been announced that the sun's rays have blessed SLIM with enough energy that it looks like it'll be able to continue its mission. More from our Tokyo correspondent, Shaima Khalil.
We're alive, said the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency on social media after re-establishing contact with their moon lander on Sunday night. The agency, also known as JAXA, indicated that the glitch in communication had been fixed. JAXA said the solar panels of the Smart Lander for Investigating the Moon, or SLIM, are working again after a shift in lighting conditions allowed them to catch the sunlight. In another social media post, JAXA shared a photograph taken by SLIM of a nearby rock nicknamed the Toy Poodle, because that's what it looks like. The lander will analyze the composition of rocks in its search for clues about the origin of the moon. The probe touched down on January the 20th, but soon after, the agency said that problems with the craft's solar batteries meant they were not generating power, as the solar cells pointed away from the sun. SLIM landed at the edge of an equatorial crater known as Scioli, within 180 feet of its target, which has been described as an unprecedented pinpoint landing. JAXA could not immediately say how long SLIM would operate on the moon. It's previously said the lander is not designed to survive a lunar night, when the surface of the moon gets no sun for about 14 days.
Shaima Khalil. Coming up, we'll hear from Paris, where farmers are putting the city under siege.
The price that are being given to us are far too low. We don't make a living out of farming. We are angry.
The French capital, Paris, has suffered its fair share of sieges over the years. The Vikings surrounded it back in the 9th century, and the Germans and Prussians did the same about 1,000 years later in 1871. But the latest threat to the city and to its citizens comes from closer to home. Hundreds of French farmers have converged at points around the outskirts of Paris, part of continuing protests against falling incomes, rising red tape, and competition from imports. Morgan Odie from the Confédération Paysanne, which represents small and medium-scale farmers, explained why they've decided to take action.
We produce food and we take care of the nature, so we deserve to be treated with decency. Yet, because of the free trade, because of market regulation, the price that are being given to us are far too low. We don't make a living out of farming. We work from Monday to Sunday, 70 hours a week, and we don't make a living. And that's the reason why we are angry.
Well, we got a taste there of what the farmers are complaining about, but what do they actually want their government to do? A question I put to our correspondent in Paris, Hugh Schofield.
There are all sorts of areas in which they want action, and it's true that salaries are at the heart of it, a sense that their living standards are collapsing and that they're losing status in society. There are various things which they're pushing for, which I think the government could react on. It has reacted already. For example, last Friday, the Prime Minister said that the ending of a kind of tax-free status for farm diesel, for example, which was one of the big grievances, that'll be stopped. So they will still keep their sort of tax rebate on the diesel they use. That kind of thing. There are no doubt other little measures which Attal, the Prime Minister, has up his sleeve, which will announce over the next day or two. But I'm not sure that there'll be enough to address what is quite clearly a much more overarching sense of abandonment and declining status and living standards, which is linked to global changes and the way agriculture as a whole has gone over the last years.
I mean, that threat then of an indefinite siege, which you're suggesting may now go ahead, I mean, how much of a problem is that likely to be? Are you yourself stocking up on cans of food and getting ready to batten down the hatches?
No. And I think we need to separate, you know, rhetoric from reality. I mean, governments know that the farmers are a popular cause and that they can and have often caused disruptions. But one thing that's a great disadvantage for farmers when they come to mobilise is they do have to go back to their farms. It's not possible for farmers to spend indefinite periods manning roadblocks around Paris. So I don't think this will last more than this week. I think this week will be a crunch one, but there is a European summit at the end of this week, and I think that's very much in everyone's minds. They're hoping to force concessions out of Europe as well as out of Paris.
Hugh Schofield. It's well-known wisdom about the property market that what goes up can also come down. Plenty of people have got into debt by borrowing money to buy a home, which then dropped in value. Plenty of countries have seen their property market bubble up and then burst. And yet the sheer scale of what's going on in China is jaw-dropping. The property company Evergrande is now apparently $300 billion in the red. And a judge in Hong Kong has therefore ruled that it's time to put the company out of its misery and liquidate it. But if that happens, it's not just bad news for Evergrande and its shareholders. It could have a dramatic knock-on effect on the whole Chinese economy. So how could the company have got into so much debt without being stopped by the government? A question for our China correspondent, Stephen McDonnell.
In short, because they thought they could expand enough to cover the money they owed and just kept borrowing and keeping creditors at bay, but really they were digging themselves into a bigger and bigger hole because, you know, they were selling more real estate for people when they hadn't delivered what was already promised. And the problem has got worse and worse. Now, I think, unfortunately, in China, there obviously wasn't a regulatory framework there to spot this and to say, OK, you've gone too far, $300 billion worth of debt, it's out of control. Now, belatedly, the government has put the screws on them by not allowing the banks to lend so much money, not only to Evergrande, but other property developers as well. Because they can see this is throwing good money after bad, and hence here we are.
And I mentioned earlier the threat of an effect on the wider Chinese economy. How worried are people there?
Well, the problem is that real estate used to make up about a quarter of all GDP in this country, a huge amount. And Evergrande's a very, very big player in that sector. And it's not only Evergrande that's been in trouble with debt. As I say, there are all these other companies as well, Country Garden and the like. So the flow-on effects are obvious, you know, hitting employment, hitting household incomes. And because people in China don't necessarily trust the stock market, I think they thought bricks and mortar, that's where we can put our money. But they've often bought apartments off the plan which haven't been delivered, and so it's hitting ordinary people.
Stephen McDonnell. It's only a couple of years since Sri Lanka was being written off as an economic and perhaps political basket case. The currency was plunging, there wasn't enough food or fuel on the island, and angry mobs were storming the homes of unpopular politicians. Well, things haven't worked out quite as badly as the doomsters predicted. And there are signs of Sri Lanka's economy getting back on track. But there's one area that's perhaps suffering even more than before. Healthcare. Because more and more doctors and other medical workers are moving abroad in search of better pay. From Sri Lanka, our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Ethirajan has this report.
A bright and sunny morning in the Sri Lankan capital, and I'm outside the main government-run cancer hospital in the city. Tucked inside a lane, the National Cancer Institute provides specialized treatment for the disease, drawing patients from across the country. Dozens of men, women and children are waiting for their turn to be called in. One of those in the queue is Niluka Sanjeevani.
My 5-year-old son is suffering from leukemia. Treatment here is fine, but nowadays there's a shortage of medicine, or sometimes the drugs we are given are out of date. So we have to buy medicine from private pharmacies. Our medical expenditure has gone up from $400 a month to $600. We're struggling to find the money for my son's treatment.
Sri Lanka has a universal healthcare system that offers free treatment and medicines to all its citizens. However, following a devastating economic crisis in 2022, the country ran out of foreign currency reserves that led to import curbs on fuel, food and medicines. Doctors say hospitals across the country are facing drug shortages and prices of medicines have also shot up. A busy morning here in Dahedakindia Hospital in eastern Sri Lanka, where I see dozens of patients waiting for the turn. This particular hospital made headlines when it was known that the only surgeon this hospital had left the country about 5 or 6 months ago for higher studies. The impact of the shortage of specialist doctors is felt even in hospitals like this one in Colombo. Doctors' Union says more than 1,200 medical professionals, many of them consultants, have left the country either for higher studies or looking for better opportunities in the past year. Dr. Haritha Aludke is from the Government Medical Officers Association.
Actually, it's an alarming situation at the moment, and the situation has very negatively reflected within the health sector of this country. For example, a few days back, one of the major hospitals within the Colombo suburbs, that is Base Hospital Homagama, had to stop surgeries for 3-4 days because the two consultant surgeons attached to the base hospital have left the country.
The Sri Lankan Health Minister, Ramesh Pathirana, insists that with the economy making a slow recovery, the issues will be addressed.
Generally, yes, we need to have more surgeons in the country. We have to, you know, fill that gap, but, you know, there's no acute shortage as such.
Sri Lanka boasts one of the best primary healthcare systems in South Asia. But without a major economic growth, it will be a challenge for the authorities to address the growing medical needs of the people.
Anbarasan Ethirajan. The British jazz singer George Melly had a rather remarkable end to his career. He was suffering badly from dementia, unable to remember very basic things. And yet he could still perform note perfect. But this was really just a particularly striking example of a more general phenomenon. The people with dementia often retain an appreciation of music long after their other faculties have faded away. But now there's evidence that listening to and especially playing music earlier in life can actually stave off dementia. Anne Corbett is Professor of Dementia Research at Exeter University in the UK and was involved in the study. She described their findings to Nick Robinson.
What we saw when we analysed the data was that people who engaged with music throughout their life, particularly those who played an instrument, performed better on our tests and had better memory and problem-solving skills than those who didn't. And we particularly saw that people who continued to play instruments through life were actually performing better still.
Throughout their life is an interesting phrase that you're using. So take up the piano when you're in your 60s might not do the trick.
So we didn't specifically ask that question, so we don't know that. But what we do know is that people who have played instruments through their life, usually people start when they're younger, people tend to stop playing in midlife, but some people do return or continue to play, and that does seem to have a benefit.
And do you know what the mechanism is? Because beyond, as it were, the technical skill using your brain to cope with reading music, for example, let alone playing the notes, there's also just a sense of purpose that music can give people and relaxation to.
Yes, I mean, all that is true. What we believe is that probably this falls into the same category as sort of training your brain and exercising and challenging your brain. We know that the brain is like a muscle. It sort of use it or lose it. We know that in early life, people who acquire special skills, like learning a second language, for example, do better later on as well. And I believe that probably we're seeing the same effect here. Anyone who has learned to read music or play an instrument knows that it is quite similar to learning a new language. So we suspect that it's really just people are sort of protecting their brains, making them more resilient to change or damage later on.
And what does it make you conclude as to what we should do?
I think it's clear that musical education is important early in life. And be good to see policymakers, educators prioritising musical education for children. But it also raises the question of whether continuing to engage with that music, introducing it into the sort of healthy lifestyle guidance that's so important around healthy ageing, could really help with that overall proactive approach to helping people protect their brains as they age.
Professor Anne Corbett. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Derek Clark and the producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Paul Moss. Until next time, goodbye.